This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Christians held a candlelight vigil Tuesday night in Paris to mourn the loss, for now at least, of Notre Dame Cathedral. Many priceless pieces of art were salvaged from the Gothic cathedral as a fire tore through it on Monday. President Emmanuel Macron has vowed to restore the historic landmark to its former glory within 5 years, a task which will be aided by several billionaires who have already donated hundreds of millions of euros. And as AP's Sagar Margani reports, more support is being pledged.
From the Vatican to Buckingham Palace to Moscow, world leaders say they're ready to support Paris in rebuilding Notre Dame, including Poland's prime minister, who remembers Warsaw rising from the World War II ruins. Two French tycoons have reportedly pledged nearly $340 million. On CBS This Morning, Paris's deputy mayor said Notre Dame will recover.
We'll rise up again and build it again.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
The UN Secretary General has appointed Special Advisor Nicholas Haysom to support the African Union's mediation efforts in Sudan, where the military ousted longtime President Omar al-Bashir last week. Haysom, a South African lawyer, was previously the UN Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. The African Union Peace and Security Council is condemning the military takeover in Sudan as an unconstitutional change of government and demanding the military hand over power to a transitional civilian-led political authority within 15 days. The protests begin in December, with protesters accusing al-Bashir's government of economic mismanagement that sparked skyrocketing food prices and fuel and foreign currency shortages. However, the military leaders have said it will not turn over al-Bashir to the ICC, but instead be tried in Sudan. This is VOA News. People in Venezuela's capital, Caracas, are celebrating the arrival of the first shipment of humanitarian aid from the Red Cross. Truckloads with medical supplies arrived at a warehouse in Caracas on Tuesday. From there, the aid was distributed to people who needed it. The delivery of international humanitarian aid has become a focal point in Venezuela's power struggle. Now in its third month, with opposition leader Juan Guaido declaring himself as interim president, while Guaido has rallied the international community and collected several hundred tons of aid, President Nicolas Maduro has previously refused to allow it in. The U.S. Justice Department will release on Thursday a redacted version of the nearly 400-page report of Special Counsel Robert Mueller on Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election aimed at helping Donald Trump win that position. Trump claimed on Tuesday again that he has already been exonerated of wrongdoing linked to the election, even as he and the American public await details of the prosecutor's 22-month investigation. Attorney General William Barr released a four-page summary of Mueller's findings 3 weeks ago, saying the prosecutor had concluded that Trump and his campaign did not collude with Russia to help him win, but had reached no collusion, a conclusion, that is, whether Trump obstructed justice. But with Mueller not reaching a decision on the obstruction issue, Barr and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein decided no obstruction charges against Trump were warranted. Democrats are continuing to call for the unedited version of the Mueller report. United Nations aid agencies are expressing deep concern for the safety of civilians in Tripoli as fighting moves closer to the outskirts to the center of the Libyan capital. Correspondent Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN aid agencies are particularly worried about the situation of some 4,000 refugees and migrants, most from sub-Saharan Africa, who are held in government detention centers in and around Tripoli. Of particular concern are more than 1,500 believed to be trapped in several places of detention close to where the clashes are occurring. The International Organization for Migration reports one bit of good news. It says it was able to organize a humanitarian relief flight Monday to repatriate 136 migrants to Nigeria.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. And the polls are open in Indonesia, where voters are choosing the country's next president. Incumbent Jokowi remains the favorite to win a second term. He faces Prabowo Subianto. I'm Michael Brown reporting. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo diaspora is not happy about the dissolution of the opposition coalition that led protests against President Faure Gnassingbé.
We, as the Togolese diaspora or the movement, we have decided to come together as one and discuss what exactly is going on back home in Togo.
Claudine Mate is a member of the civil society group Togo Debut. There's one less presidential candidate ahead of Malawi's May 21st election. An American general says the U.S. is not winning the counterterrorism fight in West Africa, and the U.N. is concerned about refugees and migrants as fighting escalates in Libya.
As you can imagine, this is complicated by the severely restricted access amid this security situation. And to date, we have facilitated relocation of about 150 vulnerable refugees from the Ain Zara detention center.
Liz Trussell is the spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency. A Guinea-Bissau government minister is suspected of stealing hundreds of bags of rice and the extradition case of a former Mozambican minister. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togo's diaspora community is not happy about the dissolution of the 14-party opposition coalition that has led protests to demand political and electoral reforms, as well as the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé. It's not clear why the coalition dissolved, but Claudine Mate, a member of the civil society group Togo Debut, or Togo Stand Up, says the diaspora will meet early next month to discuss how to fill the void left by the dissolution of the opposition coalition.
We, as the Togolese diaspora or the movement, we have decided to come together as one and discuss what exactly is going on back home in Togo and how we can help our brother and sister back home that's still under that 50-plus-year dictatorship regime. One of the main objectives of this conference that we're going to have on May 4th is to make sure that we discuss the socio-political crisis in Togo. The second objective for this conference is to collect, to study, and to propose different options and different views in order for us to get to the point of discussing the political reform, which is one of the main stuff the Togolese people are asking for, and make sure that Faure Gnassingbé doesn't represent us for a fourth term in 2020.
Claudine, did I hear you use the word dissolution when you made reference to the group of 14 opposition political parties that were leading the protests in Togo? Did you say dissolution and why?
Unfortunately, I did say dissolution, which just by saying that hurt my feelings, hurt my well-being, that Togolese people can't stay together and work together to fight for that dictatorship regime, for them to split because of different views, some of them just because of their own interests, and not the interests of the people of Togo. And you can see with me, since August 2017, when PNP leader TP Achiram come over for that protestation, a lot of Togolese people come out because we believe that something good is going to happen this time. But unfortunately, we fell again. I'm not going to say I fell. They fell. They failed us because we allowed them to represent the people of Togo, not to represent themselves. And they forget about that. They forget about all the people that passed away for the past 50 years, all the family that lost their child, their wife, their husband. They didn't think about all that. They think about themselves, their own interests. And it's unfortunate.
Most of the time in Africa, you have the government in power using its wealth or power to influence the opposition. Are you suggesting this is what might have happened in the case of Togo?
I'm not going to go into detail about that because it's a shame as a Togolese to come out on an international radio and expose what exactly is going on in our political party. But one thing for sure, yes, the dictatorship regime of Togo, they have power, they have wealth, and unfortunately, they are manipulating people into their camp, into what they believe they should do in order for Fonya Singbe to stay in power for a fourth term.
Claudine, thank you very much. We are so happy to talk with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Claudine Mate is a member of the civil society group Togo Debut, or Togo Stand Up. She was speaking with me from the Midwestern region of the United States. The number of presidential candidates in Malawi's May 21st election is now 7, after the Elections Commission removed former Vice President Kassim Chilumpa as the candidate of the Tikonze People's Movement, or TPM. Rafik Haja is Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Interaction. He says the commission's decision was based on a Malawi court ruling following a petition brought by TPM supporters.
In a nutshell, it appears that there's dissent amongst the ranks. The grouping that has been claiming to front is called the Tikonze movement. Tikonze actually means let's fix it. And this grouping is a grouping of about 5 or 6 very small parties, some of whom have got 1 seat in parliament. Others have got none, and got together in order to have a fighting chance in the forthcoming general election. Now, it seems that perhaps all is not well within their ranks, because apparently there was an injunction placed before a high court saying that Dr. Kassim Chilumpa was not a rightful candidate, as he has never been elected to represent the Tikonze movement. And on those grounds, the judge ruled that his candidacy was therefore null and void.
How could that be possible? How could he have declared himself as a candidate, but yet the court, as you said, ruling that he must not have been chosen or elected by the people? How is that possible?
Well, according to the complaint that was placed before the court, certain members of the party allege that Dr. Chilumpa basically, his candidacy, which he presented to the Electoral Commission, claiming that he represented Tikonze, was endorsed by someone who had no credibility or was not mandated to sign that document. So the whole process of his candidacy was brought into question. So the judge actually got no choice but to rule the way he did, because the issue is actually coming from the very grouping which Dr. Chilumpa claims to represent.
I know in Malawi there's a whole lot of political horse trading that goes on during an election. Is it possible that this problem within the Tikonze People's Movement Party could that be caused by one of the bigger political parties trying to pull people from this party?
It would be difficult to prove, but I can assure you that the bigger parties are probably enjoying the show.
May 21st is the election. What do you know about women in this race? I know the former president, Joyce Banda, has polled out. How prominent are women in these political times?
In the race for the presidency, all the candidates are men. However, it appears that in the race for parliamentary seats, women are actually taking quite a strong position. Of course, the matter will be resolved on May 21st. And in the last election, though there was a very strong drive by the donor community through civil society organizations like NGO GCN towards a target of 50-50 representation in view of the fact that women make up 60% of the population of Malawi, this time I think there are hopes that women will fare better. It is hoped that they will leapfrog up into 30s or 40s.
Rafik Hajat is the Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Interaction. You are speaking with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. United Nations aid agencies are expressing deep concern for the safety of civilians in Tripoli as fighting moves closer from the outskirts to the center of the Libyan capital. Troops fighting for renegade General Khalifa Haftar began their battle to seize the Tripoli on April 5th. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN aid agencies are particularly worried about the situation of some 4,000 refugees and migrants, most from sub-Saharan Africa, who are held in government detention centers in and around Tripoli. Of particular concern are more than 1,500 believed to be trapped in several places of detention close to where the clashes are occurring. UN Refugee Agency spokeswoman Liz Throssell tells VOA her agency is in contact with Libyan authorities, working to guarantee the safety of those detained near the combat zones.
This includes advocating with the authorities to allow the relocation of vulnerable individuals to the gathering and departure centre. As you can imagine, this is complicated by the severely restricted access amid this security situation. And to date, we have facilitated relocation of about 150 vulnerable refugees from the Ain Zara detention centre.
Throssell says the UNHCR has set up a hotline for refugees and internally displaced people stuck in areas of conflict seeking assistance. She says her agency has transferred medicine and medical equipment to the Ministry of Health. This is to support emergency units and hospitals around Tripoli. The World Health Organization reports the number of people killed since the conflict erupted April 5th now stands at 174, including 14 civilians. More than 750 have been wounded. Despite the dangerous security situation, the International Organization for Migration reports one bit of good news. It says it was able to organize a humanitarian relief flight Monday to repatriate 136 migrants to Nigeria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An already bad situation in Burkina Faso appears to be getting worse. This month alone, more than 60 people have died in ethnic clashes inflamed by Islamist extremists seeking to gain a stronghold in the Sahel. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb brings us a rare look inside the counter-terror war in Burkina Faso, where the U.S. is hoping local forces can increase pressure on the militants, even as the U.S. military decreases its force numbers in the region.
In the vast, dusty plateau of West Africa's Sahel region, the fight is heating up against an insurgency fueled by Islamist militants. Burkina Faso has seen more than 230 attacks in just over 3 years, with no end to the violence in sight.
What we fight against, what we see every day, is like a toxin.
A toxin that the U.S. ambassador to Burkina Faso tells VOA has quickly spread across a nation virtually untouched by terrorism just a few years ago.
They're trying to target the resilience of this community, which has lived in harmony for thousands of years. There are Muslims and Christians who are in the same family. Those terrorist groups try to break down a stable society and attack a fragile democracy.
Because instability provides terrorists an opening to infiltrate. It happened in Iraq and Somalia. And now, the commander of U.S. Special Forces in Africa tells VOA Islamist groups are planting their flags here.
We know that al-Qaeda considers the Sahel right here to be a very important area for them to deliberately and quietly build infrastructure. They've been doing this for a number of years, and they've been fairly successful.
Which is why Hicks says training exercises with Sahel Nation forces are critical. American commandos and international allies teach everything from how to plan operations, to how to respond to an ambush, to how to treat and evacuate the wounded. Skills that regional partners say make a big difference.
Unfortunately, we lost our guys during some operation. And if we had this knowledge, maybe we could be able to take care of them. Putting tourniquet before taking them to the hospitals.
Okay. The U.S. Embassy has heeded the call, giving more funding to Burkina Faso for security assistance. But instead of bringing in more troops, the U.S. is actually decreasing its numbers in West Africa. About 1,000 American troops will remain in the region. And General Hicks says that's still enough forces to help build local security partners.
Together, I think we can turn the tide. And this is going to be a long-term problem.
But he does not recommend any more cuts.
Is the United States winning the counter-terror war here?
I would tell you at this time we are not winning.
And officials say if the terrorists win in Burkina Faso,
It could turn into a launch pad for terrorists to expand their influence to West Africa's coast and potentially beyond. Carla Babb, VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Guinea-Bissau's Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development is suspected of stealing hundreds of bags of rice donated by the Chinese government. The controversy reached a dramatic turn in recent days when the minister barricaded himself in his office and refused to surrender to police. He was finally detained. The Conscious and Uniformity Citizens Movement is calling for the arrest and detention of all those involved. A spokesperson for the group, Carlos De Silva, tells Ricky Stryak they are planning to protest later this week if action is not taken.
Well, 1 week ago, I can say the police, they received information that those rights given by the China Republic is being transferred to other sacks, you know, and it has been sold in the market. So the judicial police, they start investigation.
How much rice was it?
It was 104 container of rice.
Like shipping containers?
Yes. So when the police, they went to the Bafata in the east, and they found some of the tons of this rice in the warehouse of the former Interior Minister, Boche Kande, that is the advisor of the President of the Republic. And so they found a lot of tons of rice there. So as the judicial police, they continued their investigation, they went in the farm of the Minister of Agriculture and they found 36 tons of rice again in this farm.
As I understand it, when they went to arrest him, he refused to cooperate and barricaded himself in his office?
Yeah, that's true. It was last Thursday. The judicial police, they went there in this investigation and they after talked to him, then they want, you know, to arrest him. But his bodyguards refused that the minister will not, you know, will not be taken. So they took him inside and they barricaded themselves inside, as you know. And later on, the minister said, okay, I will go, but he never go, you know. That's what happened.
As of now, who has been arrested and what do you think needs to be done for the other people who are suspected to be arrested?
Actually, I didn't know those people, but I heard that three people have been arrested, but I didn't know who they are. I think it's supposed to be maybe those merchandise or those people who sell, you know, those who have the small shops, you know. I think it can be those people, but in the side of the government, no one has been arrested so far because, you know, there is no cooperation between, you know, the public minister and judicial police, you know. And so it seems that the investigation is not going properly, you know.
That was Carlos De Silva, a spokesperson for the Conscious and Uniformity Citizens Movement. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bissau. More than a week after a magistrate ruled that former Mozambican Finance Minister Manuel Chang be extradited to either the United States or Mozambique over corruption allegation, Chang remains in a prison cell in South Africa. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For now, at least, Manuel Chang isn't going anywhere. The United States wants him for his involvement in a massive case of financial fraud that originated in his native Mozambique and which spans four continents. Chang is one of several dozen people now implicated on both sides of the Atlantic. He was arrested on a U.S. warrant in December while transiting through South Africa, and since then has been in a jail cell near the Johannesburg airport, awaiting his fate as both the U.S. and Mozambique have filed extradition requests. Earlier this month, a magistrate ruled that he could be extradited to either country for his role in the scandal that sent his nation's economy spiraling. The $2 billion loan, which Chang did not disclose to Parliament, allegedly was for maritime development projects, none of which came into existence. He and four others are accused of bribery, fraud, and money laundering. A U.S. indictment issued by the Eastern District of New York accuses them of intentionally diverting portions of the loan proceeds to pay at least $200 million in bribes and kickbacks to themselves, Mozambican government officials, and others. Chang has not spoken during any of his court appearances, and his family members have also shunned the press. But even so, says Alex Vines, head of the Africa program at research institution Chatham House, the issue has turned political.
The court will probably want to put this into the hands of politicians to decide whether, in effect, Mr. Chang, the former finance minister of Mozambique, goes left or right, either going to the United States or to Mozambique. Clearly, the Mozambican government would prefer that he goes to Mozambique. It's an election year there. There are elections in October. And a key part of the electoral campaign for the party of government, Frelimo, is about anti-corruption now, and having Mr. Chang in Mozambique very visible in the run-up to the elections is part of their strategy to try and win back voters who are very angry and frustrated by this undisclosed loan scandal.
That secret loan led the coastal nation to suffer a debt crisis so severe it has deprived citizens of the most essential services, like road maintenance and maintained hospitals. The government has arrested more than 18 people over the matter, but critics of the government say they doubt the arrests and prosecutions are meaningful. While the Mozambican government clearly wants him back, most citizens do not, says prominent Mozambican political commentator Fernando Lima.
I would say that there is the opinion that Mr. Chang should be returned back to Mozambique. Not only is a minority opinion, but also there is a lot of suspicion on the base that if he will return to Mozambique, eventually he will be released, eventually he will not have a fair trial, eventually all and the supposed secrets he holds, it will never be revealed.
Vines agrees.
We would learn more, I think, if he went to the United States. He would probably feel more comfortable to disclose a more robust description of what actually occurred in Mozambique. He would be probably more circumspect and cautious on the types of information he would provide in court.
Chang's legal team has another week to appeal the extradition rulings, and South Africa itself holds elections in 3 weeks, with corruption as a top campaign issue. And so, it now falls to one man to make a decision on Chang's fate, South African Justice Minister Michael Masuta. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Togo's diaspora community is not happy about the dissolution of the 14-party opposition coalition that has led protests to demand political and electoral reforms, as well as the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé. It is not clear why the coalition dissolved, but Claudine Maté, a member of the civil society group Togo Debout or Togo Stand Up, says the diaspora will meet early next month to discuss how to fill the void left by the dissolution of the opposition coalition. The number of presidential candidates in Malawi's May 21st election is now 7 after the Elections Commission removed former Vice President Kassim Chilumpa as the candidate of the Tikonze People's Movement, or TPM. Rafik Hajar, executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction, says the commission's decision was based on a Malawi court ruling following a petition brought by TPM supporters. And that is it for this Wednesday, April 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barty, wishing you a very good day.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has made headlines for pushing through unprecedented reforms. But many challenges lie ahead in creating a national consensus. Discussing Ethiopia's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.